Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shinoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Thank you again for joining our fourth season, in which we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping industry. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being challenged, replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Vikram Shyam, futurist for NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. Welcome, Vic.
Dan, thanks. Hey, I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for 15 years. I'm currently the futurist for the CAS, or Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, and I've got a background in aerospace, biomimicry, and foresight. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Vic. And today, our guest is Krista Pauly. Krista is a tri-sector leader and connector across government, corporate, and nonprofit entities. She's worked on all sides of the economic spectrum and is also an entrepreneur who has founded multiple organizations to create bridges, including as the founder of Imperative Impact and co-founder of Wavemakers, co-chair of Excite, and one of the co-founders of Singularity Canada. Holy smokes. What do you do in your spare time, Krista? We're thrilled to have you. Welcome.
Well, thanks so much, Diana. It is such a pleasure to be with you. I should add in that I'm also a mom of three curious little minds. So they're the ones who keep me busiest of all. I actually work for a little relaxation. I'm incredibly fortunate. I've had a really interesting career to this point, and I'm only halfway through it, so can't wait to see what the next half holds. I joke sometimes, and this is where the fact that I'm a mom shows up, is that I feel a little bit sometimes like the dog from Up. I'm one of those deeply curious people who, instead of a squirrel, I'll go chasing big ideas and different ways to have impact. And so that's kind of the thread that, whether it be where I started in politics and international development, moving into, I actually have an MBA in banking, and then working into spaces like food security and working
So what did you say? You have an MBA in what?
Banking.
Banking. Wow. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, trust me, it surprised me too. And then working from there, I went into the not-for-profit world, working in education and financial inclusion in sub-Saharan Africa, went and worked with the largest loyalty company in the world. So really understanding data and all of the things we can learn about why they put the beer next to the diapers on Friday nights in your grocery store. And as Diane said, now an entrepreneur working in a bunch of really interesting spaces with some of the most wonderful and brilliant people in the world. So I'm incredibly fortunate in all things and love being here with you today for this conversation.
So I'm guessing you're a very positive person, Krista, because you have three kids. So you probably don't fear too much for the future, right? You think there's a positive future ahead for them?
I really, you know what? You're absolutely right, Vic. There is nothing like spending time with children to feel better about what the future holds. And I'm coming off of Science Fair week a couple of weeks ago, and that was just, it blew my mind about what these kids were looking at, how they were thinking, and the optimism that they brought. Like, they saw challenges, but instead of being defeatist around it, the innovation and the way they were looking at things was just so incredibly inspiring. And I'm lucky. My most of my day job these days is actually spending time working with students and young people from traditionally underrepresented communities. And again, you want to feel good about the world? Come and spend a day with me learning from these young people. It is unbelievable what they can come up with and how they can see opportunity in the world that some of our older eyes don't always see.
Yeah, that's a nice thought there, because I mean, one of the things I always say is that these are the demographics that are going to be experiencing the challenges, right? In 20 years, 30 years, we're talking about AI and automation and climate change. And so it's nice that they're seeing these challenges and they're finding opportunities and such. Is that your view as well, that they're actually aware of these challenges and they're trying to address them?
I would say, yeah. And I was worried. I'll be very transparent. I was worried that we were putting so much on young people that all they've been hit with since they've been growing up are the things that are going wrong in the world. Mm-hmm. And as a parent, I will say I owned the anxiety for them because I felt that it wasn't fair. I mean, not only did we screw things up, but now we're making them feel like they're responsible to fix it. And I would encourage that maybe we probably don't need to put all that pressure on them. But what has been astounding and inspiring for me has been watching how many creative ways young people can come up with to look at challenges, find the opportunity, and most importantly, and Diane, I think this is really in your space, work in systems and with each other in collaboration. And this generation is innately, I'm seeing, more collaborative and more open than any I've had the pleasure of working with in the past. And mm-hmm. if there's an attribute that excites me most, it's probably that and their curiosity. I think one of the things that AI has unlocked is this sense of possibility that mm-hmm. the world and all the things that are currently impossible seem possible to this generation because they've seen the impossible happen. Yeah. And so I think that opens up a whole bunch of other thinking. And Diane, I know this is, again, kind of your space and a world that you work in.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Krista, I love the fact that you're working with these young, and basically tomorrow's leaders and tomorrow's society and working with those underrepresented groups and really that prismatic view of the world, that humble, curious view of the world that embraces perspectives and ideas from a lot of different lenses. Really, hopefully you're seeing it. It sounds like you're seeing it. It just having that prismatic view of what's possible really gets, I think, the communities to a better outcome, a better place, a better perspective. Are you seeing that in the work that you're doing with these tomorrow's leaders and the youth that you're working with?
I am. I will say absolutely. I'm seeing them as prismatic. I'm seeing them as optimistic. I'm seeing them as creative and curious and willing to embrace falling. I have a big thing with this whole Silicon Valley thing of embracing failure. When I put my kid on a roller coaster, I do not want that engineering firm to have embraced failure. That is not cool with me. My bank? No, thank you. Not when it comes to saving my money. Now, if you want to introduce falling into my app experience, cool. No problem. Mm-hmm. Kids today are welcoming that idea of falling and learning from living at the edge and understanding that is where learning happens. The only thing I would change of what you said is I don't find them humble and I'm great with that because I think that there is an understanding. And I would say what I love seeing is not confidence. I love seeing self-efficacy in young people.
Yes,
and I'm
for sure
that. So not that false confidence of bravado without the ability and the knowledge that underlies it, but this sense of, I know how to do this. I can do this. I have agency to do this. And being able to take that place, not in a way that displaces others or makes themselves bigger than others to the detriment of others, but in a way that there's more confidence in taking that place. And I love that. I used to be somebody who did embrace that humbleness. And I'm now recognizing for my children and for others, I want self-efficacy. I want them to have that ability to take their space and to do it in an authentic way where they also make space for others and recognize that it's not a zero-sum game. And I think that may be one of the biggest things is, at least with the people I'm working with, I'm seeing less and less of that zero-sum mindset. There's this recognition that I can be successful and you can be successful, that my success does not take away from yours and yours does not take away from mine.
We're all about and rather than or here, right? You're absolutely right. And I think we're in violent agreement on the humility and the self-efficacy and really showing up with grace. And I know, Krista, this is something that we've chatted about as well. I know this is also important to Vic and a common theme across a lot of the conversations that we have, but how much does trust play into this conversation, Krista, from your perspective?
So I believe trust is the currency of today and the future. I believe it is the thing we cannot buy. It must be earned, and it is lost so quickly. And so as leaders, as people who have the opportunity to shape the systems that we work within, I believe it is incumbent on us to focus on building ecosystems, architectures that support and enable trust, because we are seeing, I can't think of an environment or an area of focus where trust is not defining how that space is working. I spend a lot of time working in digital trust and working in and around building digital infrastructure and thinking about what that architecture needs to look like. And I am not a technologist. I learned BASIC back in 1980, and I'm not a coder, but I've spent over a decade in this space really looking at how do we make sure that the architectures that we build to underlie the digital world that we are creating are infrastructures that support, enable, and can verify trust. And that's a really big thing, because there's this old New Yorker cartoon, and I've referenced it so long, I think I owe them royalties on it, but it says, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. And it has two little dachshunds playing on a computer. But it's 100% true. So As we sit here moving towards a digital age where we're looking to these distributed communities as sources of information, as sources of learning, who are we learning from? Who are we sharing with? Is it a human? Is it the human we think it is? Odds are pretty good based on recent stats. It's very likely a bot. And then who's controlling that bot, and what has programmed that bot? And then if I go even into the nice places of large learning models, how can we be sure that the data that learning model has been trained on is one that is inclusive and one that will give me answers that are reflective of a holistic and global perspective, not just those who programmed it? And the example I'll give, and I know like ChatGPT's got the little disclaimer underneath it that says, I make mistakes, which I love. I love that the machine will own making mistakes. But I was doing a presentation to a university class a little while ago, and to prove a point around assumptions and why it's important to ask very clear questions, I asked ChatGPT to give me a picture of an entrepreneur. And it came back and it did give me two pictures. I didn't ask for it, but it gave me two pictures, and they were both white tech bros. Now, he had six fingers in one image, and in the other one, his shirt was cut off by a belt that looked really weird. So I'm feeling pretty good for graphic designers right now, at least for the immediate future. But the underlying assumption that was in there broke my trust, because it showed me that I couldn't trust that platform to come back to me with an unbiased image. And for me, I can kind of make the laugh about it, but it's a really important piece to recognize, is that It's that underlying data set, that architecture that is a foundation of our trust, and we have to be intentional about it.
So Krista, I want to jump in a bit here. So we're using trust in many different ways, and I just want to clarify. When you talk about digital trust, there's almost a scientific connotation there in terms of, have I done the research? Am I accurately representing a process, people, all of that kind of stuff? But then there's another trust, which is, for example, when you talked about interacting with school children, or perhaps interacting with different demographics, underrepresented groups, there's a different kind of trust almost, in that you're trying to build a relationship with someone. And you've seen this perhaps in politics or policy, where you're trying to get, let's say you're trying to get more people to get engaged to vote. You don't necessarily want to, perhaps, and this is not my view, this is published, so you might not want to go ahead and try to argue the facts or argue the, here's my point of view and here's where I stand. You want to listen to the person, you want to empathize with them. And it's a different kind of building trust. It's the human aspect of it, right? So which parts are you referring to when you're saying trust, or how do you define trust?
So I'm going to go back to Diane's comment about we're all about and. So this is a both and moment for me. I feel like the two-handed economist right now. I believe you have to have rigorous structures when we come to things like digital frameworks. So in Canada, we have a framework called the Pan-Canadian Trust Framework, and it's been built because, so I'm in Canada, we are a federated model, which means trying to get anything to work across our country is challenging because we have a federal government and then we have 13 jurisdictions that need to work together and they have different levels of power and authority. So I think it's also what's made Canada really good at operating on an international basis is we're so used to having to figure out models that can coexist and interconnect without being the same. So I would say that there needs to be a clear definition of trust for some of those underlying core frameworks that we're looking to build. And to your point, Vic, I believe, and I think that this is actually where there's a common thread here, that it is transparency and listening and inclusion that need to shape both kinds of trust, whether it's that digital kind of written structured trust or the human trust that you were describing. Because as you said, I am very much a believer in dialogue over debate when you are looking to actually create connection, in the need to listen more than you speak in order to understand people and to look for those places of common humanity, because that's where we start to build trust. One of my favorite quotes in this space actually comes from one of your presidents, a very old one. So Lincoln had a line that said, "I do not like that man. I must get to know him better." And for me, that's such a powerful statement, and one I really wish more people would embrace, is thinking about, if I'm going to build trust, I need to take the time to get to know you better. I need to approach you as a human being, not as an other. I think othering is the scourge of our day. And that to build that trust, I need to be transparent. And what I mean by that transparency, I do some work in an area called inclusive governance. And when we do this kind of work, we started out by inviting a number of stakeholders, many of whom think the other stakeholders have three heads and have no business being at the table. And we have conversations with all of them before we bring anybody into the room. And these are conversations that are designed around listening. And we share with all of the participants before they come into a room a summary of these conversations. And they're done under a non-attributed model. So there's no names associated with it, but with the great intention of ensuring that everyone who is in that room sees their voice reflected within that summary document. And that's critical because what it does is it enables us to surface different perspectives in a safe way and to show people that they are heard. Because how many times, I know I've been part of these, have you been asked to give feedback on something or you've been consulted on something? Government is brilliant for this. Give us your feedback. And into the giant black box it goes, and you never see anything come out, and you have no idea what's been done with what you gave in. And so I would say it is worse to do that than to not invite my feedback at all, because you have broken my trust.
Completely agree.
I hope I've answered your question, Vic. I get it.
Yeah, right. So on the trust part, I get it. Now I'm going to move to the other side of it. When you talked about listening to people, you mentioned the Lincoln quote. So what about, how do you know you're listening to the right people? So for example, let's go back to the school children example, right? So we're in North America, and if you look at the majority of children of school age, who are not going to school, they don't exist in North America. So if you talk about underrepresented or people who we need to solve for, they might be in, let's say, South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, for example. So how do we know we're reaching the right people? And this ties into the other thing you mentioned, which was, it's not a win-lose situation, it's a win. How do we do that? But that typically comes from a non-scarcity mindset, which again ties to, you know, psychological safety and such. And so it's possible that we're not maybe talking to the right people. We have a large number of people we're talking to, but maybe it's not the people that actually need to be brought up. How do we know that?
Oh, there's so many questions that you just put in there. I will own from the beginning, I do not bring a scarcity mindset to the world. So that colors my responses. I'm very much an abundance person. And I've seen abundance prove itself out so many times that I feel very comfortable arguing that we do live in a world of abundance, and it's about seeing it and welcoming it and actually leveraging that. When it comes to how do we make sure we're speaking to the right people, I think it requires some very deliberate intention. There is, in Canada, there's a lot of work that is being done that is required because of our history with Indigenous people. We have a very strong colonial history. It is a history that has done significant damage to Indigenous people, and it is one that we as settlers have a responsibility to recognize and to take steps towards. We can't undo it, but we need to make sure that A, there's reparation, and B, that we learn the lessons from the wrongs that were done. Mm-hmm. And there's a statement here that says nothing about us without us. So the first thing I would say is if the people that you are looking to work with are not around the table, you're not going to succeed. And so my first job was in international development, and it was called international development at the time. So that already I have issues with the word. And it did have a very colonial, paternalistic perspective of we're going to come in, we're going to tell you what you need, we're going to give it to you. And that is how we wound up with abandoned tractors all over Africa, and with M-Pesa actually being the thing that transformed finances in Kenya. Because the reality is, it's not for those of us in the West to tell people in emerging economies what they need. It's for us to create an environment where they are able to understand, because they know their environment best. They know what is going on in their space. They are incredibly smart and way more creative than we could ever be with what they do. And what we may be able to supply are some additional inputs, resources, or moreover, we can learn from them and potentially help scale the things that they've done well in other places. So if you talk about a place where I think listening is most important, it is in the emerging economies. I've been very fortunate in that I've had the opportunity to work and live in emerging economies, and by far the most creative entrepreneurs that I have met, the people who are best at problem solving, are those who have, to our eye, the fewest resources. And yeah. I have seen incredible things done there. And I want to be more anchored than just kind of this Pollyanna of, oh, they can do such amazing things. The number of young people. So I'll give an example. I was in Kibera, which is the largest slum in Kenya, and was working, meeting with young people who had created some financial inclusion programs that were supported by an organization I was working with. And if anybody's ever been to Kibera, it's massive. But there's no formal electricity. There's no formal way, at least at that point in time, of communicating. And there are hundreds of thousands of people. And so I said to the person I was with, well, how are we going to communicate with the young people to actually connect with them? And they said, oh, well, they use Facebook Messenger because it worked at such a low demand of data that they were able to use it as a hack instead of having to use phone lines or anything else. And because it used such little electricity, they were able to charge up. And basically, a charge of a single phone could last for up to 5 days and enable a young person to be connected. And it was actually that connection that they used to then empower their social enterprises that they were running. So you talk about innovation. I would look to the emerging economies and say, these are the people who know how to do things. If we can get out of the way and get rid of our paternalistic approach of we know how to do best, listen and understand that, yes, we can be allies and supporters, but being an ally and supporter often means shutting up and learning.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I had a quick follow-up, well, two different threads. One's a sidetrack. Yeah. So one of them is, are there any organizations that you think do this well? Who are they and what kind of models would they use? That's one part of it. The other part, you mentioned Facebook Messenger. How much of this listening and engaging with people do you think still needs to be done on a human level? Because there's so much stuff that's available through AI, through social media, and a lot of people are mining this stuff, right? So how important is that human element still, considering especially the younger generation seem to also be more transparent and willing to share everything? So, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to answer your second first question first. I think humanity is critical, and I'm trying not to be that person who's like, I'm just reading this book, so I'm going to quote it, but I am, and I am. So Adam Grant has just put out a book, which I think is absolutely phenomenal. And in it, he makes an argument, and I think it is brilliant, that says that in the future, it is no longer going to be about cognitive capabilities. It's going to be about character capabilities. And I am in violent agreement with that statement. So I believe that technology has the ability to take on a lot of the cognitive load that we carry today, but it does not have the ability to take on the character that exists within humans. And that is the differentiator. And so when I look and people say, okay, the computers are coming and either they're going to take my jobs or it's going to open up a world for us, I tend to be on it. It's opening up the world for us because that character is not something that's going to be able to be replicated by AI. And again, I am not a technologist. I have the privilege of working with some absolutely brilliant people who have been able to walk me through a number of permutations. And I'm really comfortable saying that this is the way of the future is going to be to focus on the human because that's the piece that won't be displaced. When you talk about organizations that I think are doing this well, I have to give a shout out to a Canadian organization, not because they're Canadian, but because I think they're 100% brilliant, called Digital Opportunity Trust. I'll give an example of why I love them. And this is from a few years ago. I was actually visiting one of their programs and Dot ran a program with Microsoft in a community in Kenya, and they were looking to support small entrepreneurs in this community. And this was a traditional Muslim community. And what I thought was brilliant in the design that they used here is for instructors, they trained up young women in the community. And the young women got all of the training to be the teachers. They got the intensive. They could program. They knew how to run businesses. They were absolutely phenomenal. And then they gave the young women, and they were young women, so in their 20s, they gave the young women the money to distribute to the small enterprises that would be started up as part of this program. So the young women were the teachers who taught the students, and the students were largely middle to older men. And the young women, there were some other women who were students, but it was mostly men. So the young women were the teachers and the ones responsible for doling out the money to those businesses that they saw as having the greatest potential. And they did have to report on why. So there was a lot of audit around it. And the brilliance of that model to me is just, it's striking because it showed that they had really listened to the community, that one of the challenges there had been around education for young women and how to enable them to take place in the community and how to demonstrate that they were fully capable of doing, of taking on leadership, of being teachers, of being the people that men could look to. And they created a program that created a win for both. Because you'll notice it didn't take away from men's agency in this environment. It gave men the skills and the financial resources to pursue the goals that they had. And at the same time, also achieved a goal of promoting women as leaders within the community. And I love that kind of thinking. I would say Acumen does great work in this space as well. The Omidyar Fund does. O'Connell Foundation is another one. And I have to call out, I am a BMW Foundation responsible leader, and that's a big part of what our network is about having some smart people around the world listening to much smarter people and trying to find system solutions.
I would add another organization to your list, and I know there's been a lot of conversation about this group as well, but Samasource, if you're familiar with them, have a very similar model. And I just love the founder's origin story. And now Wendy Gonzalez has taken up that leadership as well. We've had Wendy come in and talk to our team as well. But it's just that very thoughtful, intentional design of how you can knit together experiences and economies and communities really in a way that basically elevates the experience, the utility for all, right? The economy. And I know, Krista, we're going to continue the conversation about humility versus self-efficacy. I believe it's and not or, but I think the humility that I'm hearing from you of right, how we can share. So the developed economies and markets can interact with the emerging markets and economies, if you will, with some humility and maybe a different worldview on what we need to learn, what we need to hear, and how we can share value both ways, right? So that because there is utility in sharing research, right, that may be developed in a more mature economy that could be beneficial in a more emerging economy. So we just need to be very thoughtful, very intentional, and very humble as we're engaging in the exchange of value across economies and cultures. So I really love kind of that pause that I'm hearing in your guidance, that we need to press pause and maybe step back and understand that there needs to be some learning that needs to take place before we make assumptions regarding what is best for that exchange of value. So Vic, back to your point about really the kind of the best practices in kind of these kinds of models. I know we have been looking at these ecosystemic models across a multitude of sectors, right? Industry, policy, the economy, and society. And I think there are some lessons that just as we kind of reflect back on this conversation and start to wrap it up, I can't believe that this time has gone so quickly, but there are some common threads in what I'm hearing from Krista, Vic, and themes that really kind of aggregate up to ecosystemic model best practices, right? It's that learning orientation, right? Earning, learning, and enablement pathways, the design of those. And Krista, we've talked about universal design, right? We need to approach the design of these pathways with a focus on learning, a focus on listening, and a focus on right, making sure that the right voices and perspectives are around the table as those designs are being crafted, if you will. So maybe, Vic, some of your thoughts regarding how this kind of maps back to some of the conversations that we've been having.
Sure, Dan. I don't think I can add much more than you did, but I think I took away from what Krista said that there's an importance. It's important to be transparent. And I think that sharing back the learnings and what you're doing with the stuff you're getting from people, that's as valuable as, or maybe more valuable than even asking for their opinions in the first place. And then the other thing I heard from you is even letting the people be involved in solving the problems, which is something we're trying to do as well, bringing the communities to actually be part of the solution because they understand their context better than everyone else. So yeah, that's my takeaway.
Yeah, I love that. And Krista, to your point earlier, I love that concept of nothing about me without me. I think that's so important. And even just looking back to the work that you've done in banking, right? And the introduction of these general purpose technologies in the financial services arena, right? AI is becoming basically infrastructure in the banking arena. And back to your point, it's providing decision assistance. And if it is fundamentally flawed in its design or its data or its kind of decision architecture, then that can affect lives, right? So how do we start to course correct where we might have been perhaps overly optimistic about the utility today of these tools? How do we make sure that we're not introducing risk or bias or unintended consequences into these systems, Krista, from your perspective?
It's a great question. I'm actually going to draw again on some indigenous language that I think is brilliant, is start using seven generation thinking. And what that means is indigenous people, when they take decisions around land use or anything that could potentially impact them or the community, they don't think about it as just how does this impact me in the place that I am today, but they think seven generations out. And so that mindset of not making your parents proud, but making your great grandchildren proud of decisions that you've made, I think is a really powerful one. And it's one that we can bring into any sector because, again, I've worked in banking. I know them to be a place full of really wonderful people who actually really want to do great things. And so recognizing we're all humans, using that lens of the decision I'm making today, be it around a technology, a policy, is it something that is going to make my great-grandchildren proud? And so questioning how the data is sourced is critical, looking at what that data set is. And if the data set isn't one that you have confidence in, then taking active measures to ensure that you bring together different perspectives and different data sets that are able to balance that out. So I think we know that a lot of the data we're working with today is biased. And I do believe that we have an opportunity to transform that data set with intentionality. That's one of the principles of universal design, is to ensure that as we design these models, that they are applicable and inclusive to everybody. And the reality is, for those of us who, and I tend to be a fiscal conservative, for those of us who are fiscally conservative, it's cheaper. It is so much less expensive to do the thing right in the beginning than try to bolt on changes as it becomes an embedded system. So investing now to bring these inclusive data sets to the core, investing now to take the time to think about creating systems that are privacy enhancing, that are secure, that build trust and are convenient, because the reality is if it does all the others, but it's not convenient, that's a problem. And I mean, that's why we're seeing, if I think of some of the data and identity spaces, we see people logging in with Google and Facebook all the time. And the reality is it's because of the convenience. It's not because it protects your privacy or it's any more secure. So really thinking about how do we hit those four objectives. And I do believe that the principles of universal design are absolutely critical as we move forward, because the way you can build trust is with that intentionality of inclusion. And when I'm talking about inclusion, I'm not just talking demographic inclusion. I am talking inclusion of different backgrounds, inclusion of different perspectives, the ability to bring more people to the table. And frankly, my guidance is to try to bring as many voices as is manageable to the table to provide feedback into a system design. Because if you've spoken to one person with a disability, you've spoken to one person with a disability. You need to actually have some critical mass in order to create experiences and systems that are truly universal in their design. But when you do that and you do it with intentionality and you do it well, you have the potential to create something that's truly transformative. And I'll use a very quick, because I know we're coming on time, but I'm going to use an example. I run a program called Wavemakers. It's the world's first national work integrated learning program that's delivered in virtual reality. And I didn't do it in virtual reality for the technology. I did it because we wanted to figure out how do we offer really meaningful work experiences to those individuals who face the greatest barrier to accessing those opportunities. And it's all done through avatars. And at the end of one of my career fairs, I had a student come up to me who had started our program incredibly quiet and came from a remote part of our country and had never really spoken up before. This is a young woman who's in a wheelchair. And she came up to me and she said at this career fair that we were having in our virtual world, she said, "You know what? For the first time in my life, I feel seen for my abilities and not my disability." And for me, that is what it means to use technology to create inclusion. And it is possible to do. Frankly, it can actually be really fun to do. It is profitable, and it is what will make us sustainable. And it's what's going to make us great ancestors.
I love that. And I can't think of a better way to kind of wrap up this conversation with that, right? So let's all aspire to be great ancestors with universal, thoughtful, inclusive, and intentional design of our systems. I think we do this right, Krista. Keep me honest here, but if we are effective in our ecosystemic design, we're getting it right at the individual level, and we're getting it right at the system of systems level, because we're being thoughtful about the implications for all of the participants within the system, and we're designing with that in mind. So that's the aspiration to be a great ancestor, because we have designed excellent ecosystemic futures. So Krista, thank you so much. I know we're up on time. If you could leave our listeners with one final thought or recommendation, what would it be?
I would say my call to action or thought is summary of what you just said, Diane, which is each of us, each of you has the ability to create the future that you want to be part of. And it's on an individual level, because the individual has the ability to shape the team. The team has the ability to shape the organization. The organization has the ability to shape the community. The community has the opportunity to shape the world. And so I fundamentally believe that each of us has that role as the butterfly that flaps its wings to make the change. And it is possible.
Fabulous. We agree. We're in violent agreement on that point. Krista, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating conversation. We love your work and your worldview, and we appreciate the fact that you have joined our community and our conversation here at Ecosystemic Futures. So with that, folks, we're going to have to wrap up the discussion today, but please do stay with us if you enjoy this. Please subscribe, please like, and please keep an eye out for additional conversations like this at Apple Podcasts or your favorite source for podcasts, or shoshimworks.com. So thanks, everyone. Have a great day.
Thanks so much, Dan and Vic.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shoshimworks.com.